Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You've got to have the right seed, number one. Number two is tender, loving care. You can't just chuck them in the ground and hope they grow.
That's Philip Vowles. He's been growing vegetables in Wales for more than 30 years, but these aren't your average veg. Philip's zucchini, known as marrow in the Vale of Glamorgan, are as big as a small human.
You've got to be working with them every day, night and morning, controlling the plants, covering the main runners, and watering every morning, every night. You can't miss. You've got to do it every day. You've got to be very, very sure about it. You can't just go away for a week's holiday and leave them.
So how does your wife feel about that, that she can't get you to leave the house and go on a nice getaway?
Well, she calls herself the allotment widow. My backyard garden is, my allotment, is only just 100 yards up the road. So the wife has got a bell at the back of the house, and she rings a bell to let me know food is on the table.
That's commitment. I saw a picture of you lying on the ground, curled up next to your veg. A marrow, what we call zucchini. It was nearly as big as you are. How much did that thing end up weighing?
Well, this year, it won a great weight, but it was 80 pounds. But it's not the best. I've grown them 120 pounds. But we have not had a great growing season. Still, it won the very big show locally. So, you know, I beat all the other contestants.
And is this why you do it? Is it a competitive thing or is it?
No.
Okay, so tell me the deep secret of how you fell in love with doing this.
Well, I'm just an amateur gardener. It was just a bit of fun. I started off in the local village, but it's grown and grown. And we get them coming from all over Great Britain to enter in the village show. And it's all just a load of fun. I've selected my seed now for the last 30 years. Every year I reselect it and keep it, and it seems to get better and better.
Is it better not just in the sense of being able to grow gigantic, but also in the quality of the eating?
I don't think there's any difference in the quality. I should think it's equal to a small vegetable, like a giant cabbage is only one season's growth. And like the marrows, which I'm growing up over 100 pounds most of the time, and they only take 4 to 6 weeks for the actual marrow to grow.
They're like crazy. Can you like actually watch them grow?
Well, my neighbor, who is 98, he sits in the polytunnel and he says he can see them grow because, you know, they grow 12 inches in a week.
That's just incredible. Have you ever done a time-lapse video of them growing?
No, we haven't. That's because I'm only amateur.
Tell me, in terms of the seeds themselves, give me an idea of the difference in size between a regular marrow seed, for example, and a seed used to grow a giant one.
Well, my seed now is almost the size of my thumbnail. You know, and an ornery marrow would be my little finger's nail.
As from the seed, so grows the giant plant.
Yes. You know, like my own seed now is twice the size of a normal seed.
You're in the Guinness Book of World Records, I understand. What were some of the records that you took?
Well, I grew the heaviest cucumber, but that was 20 years ago.
How heavy was it?
It was 18.5 pounds.
And these days, how big are they growing them?
Oh, they've grown them. I think it's more like, 28 pounds.
Wow.
Yes, the records are going up every year.
How old were you when you started farming?
From 14 years of age, I started working on a farm. I worked on the farm for 26 years, done a bit of everything, with sheep and cattle and combining. And then I was made redundant from the farm. I went a self-employed gardener.
And do you ever sell any of your produce?
No, I give it to the neighbours. I got quite a large family, which I share all the spare vegetables around. I also give a lot of my plants away to try and improve, you know, the competition in the shows.
Oh, how generous of you.
Well, yes, yeah.
Is one of the ways that you put all the vigor from, let's say, a marrow vine into one plant, do you pinch off all the other fruits?
I do, yes. It's usually I leave two fruits per plant.
And then the cabbages. Just give us an idea of the size of some of these cabbages.
Well, usually they grow the size of an armchair, which is like 6 foot by 6 foot. But I've actually got one there now. It's got about 10 heads of cabbage on it, on the one stalk, which I'm hoping would possibly be close to a world record.
Oh my gosh, you must have so much anxiety that one of them's going to fall off or the whole thing is going to crush itself.
Yeah, but this is the joy of growing. You know, you've got to take the good luck with the bad luck.
Yeah, I hear that. What do you do with these vegetables once they're harvested?
Most of my big cabbage go to the local pub and they cook them up for Sunday lunch. So they feed in 100, 120 people. And of course, the wife makes a lot of chutney and things out of the marrows.
Oh, I can only imagine. I mean, those of us in Southern California who plant a few zucchini plants, we bemoan the fact that the harvest is so heavy just with our regular size ones.
That's right. Yes, yes. But we got such a nice community where we live. We share it out and people have them to make chutneys and preserve them for the winter months. And very often, if something is damaged a bit, I feed it to my chickens. I keep chickens in my allotment. So the chickens clear the worst of it off. So nothing wasted, really. It's all recycled. I get so much enjoyment out of it. You know, it's my everyday hobby, and I just love it. And I have the local school coming down. They'll take part, you know, and I'll show them what I'm doing. I'll give them plants to take back to the school. And that's what I like doing, is trying to encourage young people to get involved, because, you know, I've had so much enjoyment after growing.
That's Philip Vowles. We reckon he's got the biggest green thumb in the UK. Go to our website to find out what he's growing. We've also got a video that you can watch of Philip hanging out with his giant marrow. Next, we go on a mushroom hunt in Northern California. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. You can find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts at our iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
It's a great state to live in if you're looking for edible mushrooms, or really any mushrooms, because you can just sort of follow the season from the coast to the mountains and back again.
That's Christian Schwarz. He's the founder of Redwood Coast Tours in Santa Cruz, California, where he leads mushroom hunting expeditions. Chris has been interested in fungi since he was 16.
There's a lot of really popular ones like king boletes, morels up in the Sierra, chanterelles are really popular, matsutake, the list sort of goes on and on.
And in what kind of conditions do most of them grow?
Well, they're really variable. I mean, they're all different species with their own different preferences, one to the other. All of them require wet soil, wet forest soil. So it's after the rains, it's really fall and winter on the coast that you're finding most of these things. Although there's definitely a set of spring species that are pretty highly sought after, like candy caps, black trumpets, things like that. But in the Sierra, it's in the summer. So when the snow melt happens, that releases a lot of moisture into the soil, and that's when a lot of things fruit. And then late summer, there's thunderstorms, and that can bring quite a bit of fungal activity to the surface, and then into fall until the frosts come.
So some mushrooms grow in clusters, and some grow sort of in a more scattered fashion above their mycelium mat. What makes that happen?
I wish I could tell you the answer. It's not just clustered and scattered. There's all sorts of different ways that fungi can produce their fruit bodies. So you referred to a really important point, which is that the mushrooms that we see are not the same thing as the mycelial mat, which is the body of the organism underground. So part of it just depends on how much energy they've got to make their fruit bodies. So if they've got a lot of resources at their disposal, they can make more fruit bodies, and you might be more likely to see them in a clustered grouping rather than one or two scattered as single fruit bodies. But obviously there's some genetic component that makes it so some fungi never fruit in clusters and some fruit, you know, singly. But I really don't know the root answer. I can't give you the definitive answer to that.
So you keep saying fruit bodies. For people who haven't read a ton about mushrooms, does that mean that the mushroom is the part of the plant that releases, well, in this case, I guess it would be spores, so it can reproduce?
Yeah, so first of all, fungi are not plants. They're their own kingdom, Kingdom Fungi, and it's a kingdom that's actually much more closely related to animals. So you and I have a much more recent common ancestor with a fungus, any fungus, say a portobello mushroom, than either of us do to a sunflower. So they're much more like animals than they are like plants. And then as for your second point, yeah, the fruit body is just the sexual reproductive structure of the organism. It's not the whole thing. So most of its biomass is underground or in the wood, totally out of sight, not detectable by humans, really, until they produce a fruit body. When they're getting ready to reproduce and spread their spores, that's what we see above ground. That's what we eat, what we gather for the table. But it's really a very short part of that organism's life cycle, which is one of the reasons that mushrooms are such a sustainable forest product. It's much more like picking a berry than it is like, you know, harvesting a tree. You don't actually kill the organism when you're doing it.
Give us an idea of how large some of these organisms can be.
Really, really, really quite large. Some of the world's largest living things are fungi. I just went to the Mycological Society of America conference, which was held in Berkeley this year, and one of the original discoverers of the humongous fungus, which is a honey mushroom mycelium, a single individual in Michigan, I believe it is, it was discovered a couple decades ago and was thought to be, I forget how many acres it is now, but it's sort of a landscape scale, you know, many tens of acres that this single individual covers. And I believe that some of them are even in the thousands of acres. And he went back recently and found that that individual is still there. So these are things that have, you know, an underground biomass comparable to a whale. So some of the oldest and largest living organisms on Earth are fungi.
It's totally fascinating. What purpose do the gills serve?
Okay, so not all mushrooms have gills. Some mushrooms have other sort of fertile surfaces. But the fertile surface in general, however it's shaped, whether or not it's little teeth or hanging icicles or gills or pores or even just a wrinkled surface, that's just an adaptation to maximize surface area. So a way of making a lot of spore-bearing tissue without investing too much resources into making that structure. So it's a way of really being efficient about producing spores.
Is there a way, I mean, this is such a silly question in a way, but is there a way to identify which fungi are edible?
There is only the obvious answer, which is that you have to learn them one by one. It's really a matter of joining a community of people who can teach you what the good edibles are in your area and what the dangerously toxic species are, and learning those first. So I really recommend to people, if you're getting into foraging for wild mushrooms, start with the toxic species, because those are the ones you really need to know. Then move on to the edible species. And once you've got a handle on that, which is usually, you know, 10 or 20 species in any given area, then you can feel comfortable and let sort of the rest of the diversity of mushrooms, you can learn those later, one by one, slowly. Usually it only takes a year or two to really get up to speed and feel comfortable and confident and like you've got the skills to safely pick wild mushrooms for the table.
I mean, this is one of the things I love the most about mycology and mycological societies, is that it's a lot like bread baking in that it's a lot easier if you don't do it in isolation.
Yeah, it's much faster and much safer to have people to sort of fact check you and correct your errors and give you validation on your way.
Yeah, and it's also, I don't know, it's more comforting. It's what it used to be, basically, where people would learn as children by the side of their parents.
Right. And I think that's sort of a dramatically sad thing about the place that we are in the modern world, is not having, at least in the United States, not having really long and deep traditions of being out in the woods and getting sort of immediate connection to it through our stomachs, you know, having sort of a sensory experience of the outdoors and of nature that you can sort of envision it coming back home with you and providing sustenance to you. It gives you a totally different way of valuing wildness than simply going out and taking a hike. And I think, honestly, hunters and fishermen really access that in a way that makes them, in some cases, very strong advocates for conservation that I wish we had for mushrooms and plants.
Yeah, it's so true. Sometimes I wonder if firefighters who work forests a lot ever become mushroom hunters, because there's a link between fire and mushrooms, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Morels are sort of the famous story where a mountain forest in California burns one year in the summer, and then the next spring or the next couple springs, sometimes even three or four springs, it produces morels in large quantities. Morels are an extremely highly sought after wild edible mushroom. And it's my understanding that in a sort of medieval Europe, there had to be laws passed to sort of prevent peasants from burning down the forest so that they could cultivate the highly profitable morel crop following the fire. I don't know if that's true, if that's an apocryphal story, but it gives you the sort of sense of how highly sought after morels are and how reliably they can be found after a fire moves through a forest. I have no idea if firemen get into it or if they are too busy fighting the fire. I mean, they'd have to be there the spring after the fire in order to really see the mushrooms.
Or maybe forest rangers, people who are constantly walking through.
I think a lot of people are introduced to it that way by their jobs putting them in contact with mushrooms accidentally and their sort of bizarre appearance. Sometimes they're just in such tremendous numbers that people get curious about them, or they have such bizarre forms and colors. But I think you're right. I think a lot of people are introduced to the world simply by curiosity and sort of bafflement more than anything.
This occurrence where morels are more likely to occur after a fire, is that because the mycelium under the ground is more sensitive to the fire and it forces them to fruit more? It thinks it's going to die?
That is definitely one of the hypotheses about why morels are so abundant after fires, that, you know, their mycelium is there beforehand and it's sort of a last-ditch effort to produce spores. Some people think that it's simply the disturbance of their host tree being killed and they sort of are pushed into releasing spores to find a new safe spot. Some people think it's the soil chemistry change because it gets quite basic after all that wood ash is on the ground and water leaches through it. But a lot of the ecology of morels is still fairly mysterious. People don't really know if they are in symbiotic relationships with plants in the way that some other mushrooms are, or if they're sort of on their own, they just decompose the duff, or if they do a little bit of both and they sort of facultatively move between one state and the other.
So when you say a symbiotic relationship with plants, does that include this relationship that so many fungi species have with trees?
That's right. That's what I'm referring to. It's called the mycorrhizal relationship. And that's basically where the underground parts of a fungus wrap themselves very tightly around the roots of a tree or a woody plant usually. And they exchange nutrients with the tree and water in exchange for sugar. Because like I said, fungi are not plants. They can't photosynthesize, sort of making it possible for them to live in nutrient-poor areas or areas where water is scarce. And in return, the fungus gets carbohydrates that it can use to turn into its fruit bodies, its mushroom structures when the rains come.
And then often this exchange also ends up in this byproduct of enriched soils.
Right. So this is of interest, obviously, to people who study climate change and global warming, the carbon cycle. It turns out that roots of trees that are colonized by mycorrhizal fungi rot much more slowly than those which are not, sort of keeping carbon out of the air, at least for longer cycles than it would otherwise.
So interesting. I guess we can't have a conversation about mushrooms and fungi without asking about hallucinogens. Are there a lot of species of mushrooms that are hallucinogenic, or just a few?
Well, compared to the total diversity of fungi, I think the answer is just a few. That said, there's a surprising number, at least to me, and they're not all the same compound either. Most of the ones that people are familiar with are in the genus Psilocybe. Noah Siegel and I just wrote a book to the mushrooms of the Redwood Coast, a field guide, and I think we have 5 species of Psilocybe fully illustrated, and that's just for our range, and there are many more in other parts of the world, South America, Central America, and Mexico.
Learn more about the field guide that Christian Schwartz and Noah Siegel just published. It's called Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast. It's on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
As a purist, before I cook anything, if it's an amazing tomato, it should always just be eaten with olive oil, salt, and pepper.
That's Holly Jevin, chef de cuisine at The Bazaar in Beverly Hills. Tomatoes are, of course, at the top of her shopping list this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. So let's go there to find out more from Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. You know, the peak of summer always invokes delicious dishes using everyone's probably perennial summer favorite, tomatoes. We have so many delicious tomatoes at the farmers market. They come from multiple counties throughout the state. It's the outdoor heirloom tomatoes that everybody's so crazy over. I'm talking right now with Holly Jevin, who is chef de cuisine at The Bazaar in Beverly Hills. Holly, you have your eye on some tomatoes today. Tell us what you're looking for.
Yes, so finding the perfect tomato during season is kind of like finding the holy grail for a chef. We wait towards the summer when it's nice and hot in California and really wait until not only do you have that amazing smell of the tomato, but you also have the sweetness. Lately, my newest project has been trying to find the perfect cherry tomato. We do the Not Your Everyday Caprese, which has mozzarella spheres. So it's about a teaspoon. So really trying to find the perfect tomato that's the size that complements the sphere. It's not as easy as you think. One of my favorite cherry tomatoes at the farmer's market are Sun Golds. They're sweet, they're delicious, they're beautiful, but they're just a little too small. So I've really been searching around. I love the tomatoes from Coastal Organic. That's one of the ones I'm using right now. Maggie's Farms has amazing ones. Tutti Frutti, also the great size. And so just kind of scavenging around the farmer's market, trying to figure out which one I want to use this week and what colors they're going to be and what the sweetness are, and then bringing them to the restaurant and letting everybody else enjoy is really a great thing to look forward to.
When you are cooking with cherry tomatoes, putting them on a dish, are you leaving them whole? Is that why size is so important?
We actually blanch them and peel the skins off. And then we like to say at the restaurant that we impregnate them. We put them into a gastrovac with a mixture of vinegars and let them marinate.
How do you peel a tomato?
So we actually take a small paring knife, make a little incision at the top, blanch them in boiling water for about 6 to 7 seconds, shock them in ice, and then just peel them really gently with our fingers.
When you say you like to smell the tomato, can you literally determine different smells, especially in cherry tomatoes because they're so small?
They are small, but I think that there's just a familiar smell. It really reminds you of when my mom and my grandma used to grow tomatoes when I was small and walking in the garden and smelling them and them teaching me how to know when it was time to pick them. Just a childhood memory that kind of comes back.
You know, the bane of a lot of farmers' existence is people who squeeze the tomatoes. And I've heard that farmers can lose up to 25% of their table tomatoes from people squeezing. So when you're looking at the perfect tomato, how do you know it's like ready to eat?
It's kind of like touching an avocado. You know, you never want to squeeze too much, but you should be able to pick it up and just kind of know it's not too firm, it's not too soft. If it's too soft, we're making a sauce. If it's too firm, we're going to let it sit and ripen a little bit more.
Cooking-wise, I mean, if you're trying to preserve them for the winter, are you making lots of sauce or tomato juice or what?
I am notorious for every now and then getting some seconds from the farmer's market and making a bolognese and freezing it. One of my husband's favorites.
All right. Well, Holly, thank you so much. That sounds delicious. And thanks for coming to the market.
Very nice to meet you, and thanks for having me.
That was Holly Jevin. She is a chef de cuisine at The Bazaar in Beverly Hills, and she is loving our summer tomatoes here at the market. I'm talking now with Pernilla Carpenter. She is married to Mark Carpenter, who is the owner, along with his mom, Marianne Carpenter, of Coastal Farms. Carpenters have been coming here for years. They're very well known for their summer tomatoes. And Pernilla, you're back here having way too much fun sorting out boxes of mixed tomatoes. What kind of tomatoes are you growing?
We are growing a ton of tomatoes. We've got a lot of varieties of the heirlooms. We've got a ton of cherry tomatoes. We do mini heirlooms. And we do quite a few red tomatoes. So we've got a whole big variety of lots of yummy things.
When you say heirloom, I know a lot of people use that word. What is an heirloom tomato?
Mainly people refer to a tomato that's an older seed. It is also just an open pollinated tomato. So it doesn't have to be years and years and years old. There are newer varieties of heirloom tomatoes.
Do you, when you plant all your tomatoes, and I know you plan all year for this, do you put seeds in the ground or do you start your own seedlings?
We actually do use our nursery. they are right down the road from us, and they do the seeds for us, and we get them as little starts, and we put them in the ground like that.
How long does it take for a tomato to start producing fruit?
I would say about 90 days.
Pramila, do you have a special favorite tomato you love?
I love them all. It's hard to pick. I'd have to say I'm really partial to heirlooms. When I make tomato salads, I like to have a lot of color in it, different taste. It just makes it for a beautiful salad. Yeah.
Pramila, were you a farmer before you married Mark?
I was not. I was actually a hairstylist. I went to beauty school and I became a cosmetologist.
So what's a typical day for you as a farmer now?
It starts early. I get the kids ready to go off to the sitter, and usually one of the grandmas, thank goodness, we have them around. They're such a big help. And once I get to the farm, it's just straight into work and packing, packing, packing all day.
Not picking.
No, we are lucky to have a good crew. We're very, very lucky to have a good crew. And packing is an all day, twice a week thing, getting ready for market every Tuesday and Friday, just packing what we need to get ready.
At the end of a day, how many tomatoes just get so ripe that they can't be sold? Is there quite a bit of loss?
I am actually surprised that we are not having a lot of loss. We will compost what isn't able to be sold. I'm surprised at how little waste we actually have.
Pernille, a lot of people really think your tomatoes are the best. Do you know why they're so good?
I honestly think that it's just because Mark puts so much of himself into it, and it's just a real labor of love and blood, sweat, and tears and everything. And just his soul that goes into it.
Right. Well, you're here now. You're going to be here for another couple weeks. You come to the Wednesday Santa Monica, Saturday Santa Monica. Where else do you go?
This is it. This is just Santa Monica Farmers Market. So we're here Wednesdays and Saturdays, but this is the only market that we do.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I mean, we're kind of right in the middle here. I guess we'll be having tomatoes as long as the weather holds out. People can come by your booth. They can check them out, get a basket of mixed cherry tomatoes, and just enjoy the season while it's here.
Absolutely. We are coming towards the end of it, but we still have a few solid weeks left.
Okay, good to hear. That was Pernilla Carpenter. She is married to Mark, and they are the owners of Coastal Farms. They are famous for their huge variety. Pernilla was telling me they grow way over 20 varieties of tomatoes. You can come and you can see them all, check them out, and taste them for yourself. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We want to see pictures of your tomatoes. We know you've been growing them and eating them all summer long. So share them with us on Twitter or tag us on Instagram. Our handle is @KCRWGoodFood. In a minute, we travel to hog farms in the heartland. Don't turn that dial.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'm really sorry if we're about to ruin your appetite.
In one instance, Evan, we looked at a case in Morgan County in South Central Illinois. A facility operator had basically run out of land on which to use his waste as fertilizer, and so he just basically loaded it into a tank called a honey wagon that holds about 3,000 gallons at a time. With his tractor, he pulled it up to a nearby hill, went to the top of the hill, and then loosened the valve at the bottom of the honey wagon and let the waste pour down a ravine. Ultimately, it made its way, as you can imagine, into a ditch, and the ditch ran to a creek, and the creek ran to a neighbor's cattle watering pond, and then to nearby Henry Creek.
That's Chicago Tribune reporter David Jackson. He just finished a 9-month investigation called The Price of Pork.
In that case, the facility operator repeated this procedure at least 9 times, dumping at least 27,000 gallons, basically wiping out the cattle watering pond, killing thousands of fish. He pled guilty to willful dumping and paid a $500 fine.
A $500 fine for dumping 27,000 gallons of farm waste into waterways. That's unreal. Did discovering such incidents move you to do this deep dive into the pork industry?
I've been looking at small town papers from across the state and proposing this project to my editors for years. I've seen how the facilities can impact rural waterways with pollutions and events and fish spills. I've seen how nearby neighbors can really be negatively impacted by the air emissions and gases. And finally, I got a green light to really dig in and start driving around the state and taking a look at this.
How many interviews did you do over what period of time?
This was a 9-month project. I brought in a team of researchers from Northwestern University's Medill Journalism School and worked with another investigative reporter, Gary Marks. And I don't know how many interviews it was, but we filled probably a dozen bankers' boxes with interview notes and government records.
In Illinois, where you are, how many large hog facilities are there?
We were able to locate about 900 large hog confinements in Illinois, but that's a really imperfect data set. We could not get our arms around how many of these facilities there are in the state, basically because the government does not know either. And they're growing at a rapid rate. We looked at the notices of intent to construct, Evan, which are really accelerating here in Illinois.
Wow, 900. On average, how many pigs are housed at each site?
At the largest 490 of these facilities, Evan, they all have more than 5,000 pigs. That's the super mega facilities account for roughly 91% of the hogs raised in Illinois.
So if residents don't want these giant hog farms in their backyards, is there any legal standing for them to stop them?
Well, basically, numerous court challenges have been filed and struck down one after another. The state laws were really written in ways that promote the growth of these hog confinements and of the livestock industry in the state.
Just the odors, if you live nearby, must be just incredibly foul. Are there any stipulations as to how close a facility can be to the nearest resident?
Yes, if a facility has 2,500 pigs or more, it has to be a quarter mile from the nearest residence. And it is an amazing odor. There's nothing quite like it in its intensity. Being near a hog confinement, depending on the confinement, but in many cases, to me as a reporter, it was really like getting slapped in the face very hard. It's sort of a paralyzing, stinging odor. And it's not just an annoying smell. The decomposing swine waste, Evan and we're talking about hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of gallons that are on site at these facilities, breaks down and forms gases like ammonia and hydrogen sulfide that really can cause respiratory problems. Those gases then mix with animal dander and fecal dust that are floating through the facility. So you have this combination of airborne particles and gases that then get vented out. I'll tell you, a quarter mile, it's still can be really sickening. And people who live that distance from these facilities showed us, and we saw ourselves, that depending on weather conditions and what's happening in the facility, still can really send this sickening odor sweeping across your home.
These huge waste lagoons, are there protocols for how they need to be kept so they don't infiltrate into waterways? And are there incentives for using them in imaginative or creative ways to create energy, for example?
There are limited instances where operations have used sort of special grants to build waste facilities that'll do cutting-edge technology. But for the most part, no, we're talking about waste that's really barely treated. It's basically held in these lagoons or holding tanks for at least 6 months, sometimes for a year, and then land applied to nearby cropland as fertilizer. Ideally, Evan, if this is all done in the right way, the lagoons hold the waste and then it's applied without a drop more than needs to be applied to the surrounding fields. And that creates kind of a virtuous cycle in which the waste turns into fertilizer that helps grow plants that then feed the pigs without any of it ever touching a river or a waterway. But obviously, when you're handling that much waste, things can and do go wrong. And we found at an astonishing rate.
Unbelievable. Did you have whistleblowers who tipped you off to some of these violations?
Not on the environmental side, Evan. We sort of ranged across a number of topics looking at these hog confinements, however. And we also looked at animal welfare, what it's like for the pigs inside the facilities. And in those instances, yes, we did tap into a network of former workers who really helped us enormously.
For employees, I would imagine it's got to be kind of soul-sucking to work in one of these contract facilities for any length of time.
I think there are some facilities where workers do end up feeling really good about what they're doing and how they're doing it and stay for years. But in general, we found that there are a lot of people who churn through this. It is spiritually very tough on people. They described how hard it is to have to euthanize piglets again and again and again and again. And they described the abuse that they witnessed from coworkers and in some cases took part in themselves. Basically, they and a number of veterinarians we talked to, Evan, described to us how this new method of raising livestock in which a worker has to handle thousands of animals at a time, has to often do repetitive tasks again and again, like castrating or vaccinating or some other procedure to the animals. And that can make it very, very hard to care. No facility operator we talked to condoned abuse. Every single one of them told us that it's disgusting. They don't want it to happen. They try to weed it out. But again and again, workers told us how when the bosses weren't in sight, people just try to hurry the pigs along or in some instances take out their frustrations on the animals.
So we've heard a lot in the past about situations with poultry contractors having to fulfill a certain set of protocols to larger meat companies to whom they contract. Is this the same kind of model?
Absolutely. It's sort of, in many ways, the entire confinement industry really started with poultry and Purdue and then moved to hogs, and many of those same techniques have been replicated. And what you're talking about here is what the Illinois operators call contract growing. And this is a situation in which a farmer puts up one of these huge facilities. Usually they cost $500,000 to $1 million to build, and then is responsible for raising the pigs, for feeding the pigs, caring for the pigs, disposing of the waste. But the pigs themselves are owned by the large companies, the Cargills and Smithfields and so forth. And in Illinois, that system is, records show, in play in at least 61% of the pigs being raised, and probably an awful lot higher, we're told anecdotally.
Wow, it's so bizarre. It's like a modern version of sharecropping.
It's really something to behold, to go into these facilities and to see the vastness of the scale, the number of animals, and the very factory-like efficiency. The industry did open its doors after a lot of asking, and we did get into a number of these facilities, and some of them are really exemplary in the way they try to handle the animals and keep the air clean and respect the neighbors and the environment. But this is a very low margin business. There's not a lot of money to be made if you're not the one who owns the pigs. And we also saw a lot of facilities where farmers were just barely hanging on, where the places were held together with baling wire and the wind on one side, and where pollution events and environmental problems just repeatedly happened, because you're talking about farmers that just don't have the resources really to do everything that they should be doing.
So I guess the big question is, how do we know if we're buying humanely raised pork? Can we trust any food labels?
There are some good labels, but what we did, and I invite your listeners to check out chicagotribune.com/pork. We tried to put a guide to the various labels. We found that in general, it's extremely confusing for consumers, and what the labels say and do are different things. And some of the labels really are almost insignificant in terms of the protections that they might reflect of the animals.
So what's the big takeaway from your reporting? What does the average person need to know?
Well, we're wondering what happens next. We looked at this big sprawling industry and we found a lot of problems, again, environmental problems, an impact on the surrounding neighbors that's extremely costly and detrimental to them, and a system in which the farmers themselves can get ground up by the work. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois responded to the journalism by saying that this really ought to be looked at and that there ought to be scrutiny and better oversight. But he did not spell out specific steps, and we're sort of watching to see what the industry and government does next.
David Jackson is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Find a link to The Price of Pork on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, we go back to deliciousness in the form of a triangle of barely warm, perfectly made rice studded with piquant additions and wrapped in nori. It's the default Japanese snack. Sunoko Sakai says onigiri or omusubi are just a mom's answer to sushi and a convenience store darling in Japan. Sunoko has just written a book about how to make them at home. It's called Rice Craft. Tell me about eating your grandma's onigiri.
Oh my God. I think it's the highlight of my childhood. We lived by the sea, and she had this very old wood-burning oven in the living room. And she had a cast iron pot in which she cooked rice. So it's kind of the old-fashioned way with a wooden lid. And then while the rice was, well, soaking or cooking, she would just sit down and tell stories of her childhood, you know. And she was an English teacher, so she had read a lot of Shakespeare. I was about 7 or 8 years old or 9 years old when I lived with her. We lived right next door, and she would just tell us all these stories as if it just happened, you know, and I was just so curious. And she would tell us the same stories over and over about when she ate the first steak, or people didn't eat meat in Japan that much, especially when she was growing up. There was some wonderful stories. And then the rice would finally be ready. I mean, no peeking was allowed. And then when we opened the lid, the steam would rise. My grandmother's glasses would fog up, and I always noticed that. And then we have to wait, and then out of this beautiful white steam, we will see pearls of grain standing up, and that was the cooked rice, and she would just take a wooden paddle and toss it. And then she would make onigiri by hand and fill it up with something that could be a pickled plum that she pickled from our old plum tree, or it could just be like bonito flakes, smoked bonito flakes that she would shave and just put some droplets of soy sauce, and that would be the simple filling, you know, and then wrap it in nori. This warm onigiri was just the most delicious thing.
There are so many memories braided up in that little rice ball for you.
Oh, God, yes. And, you know, I'm not that unique when it comes to rice ball stories, because all our mothers make rice balls in Japan, you know, for bento or for a snack, or everybody has a different shape of hands and different way of molding and stuffing the onigiri. So, you know, we all have memories, and it's a really good place to start when you want to talk about your mother's cooking and comfort food.
So let's talk about the fundamentals of making it ourselves. In your book, Rice Craft, you go down into this deep, deep rice rabbit hole where you really talk about so many different varieties of rice and the different techniques needed to address each type of rice. What is the most important thing we need to know about the rice for a really good memory-laden onigiri?
Well, first of all, you want to start out with the right variety. It has to be sticky. It has to cook into a sticky grain, because that's the only way it's going to hold together. That's the glue, right? So you want sticky rice, and we use a short grain rice or a medium grain rice. In California, both are grown, but like I love Dakota Farms heirloom medium grain rice, and I use that a lot. And you could, of course, use brown rice. You could use sprouted brown rice. You could use white rice. I do blends with different grains because I really believe in introducing a variety of grains for reasons of diversity and sustainability. It's more nutritious to introduce a variety of things in your diet. So I have a lot of blends there. That's simple, right? Quinoa, millet, yeah.
And when you do the blends, do you cook them all together with the rice, or are you cooking it separately and then mixing together?
I put it in together. So if you're using beans, beans take a little bit more soaking, and brown rice also. Ideally, you want to soak those overnight. If I do a blend, I put in maybe 10% to a quarter cup. Rice is still the main ingredient because you do need that to hold it together.
Yeah, the starch of the rice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There seem to be like two main varieties. One is the kind that has herbs or little delicious, bright tastes of things mixed throughout the rice. And then some that are sort of just the rice on the outside, and then inside there's a surprise. It might be a tuna salad or salmon. Mm-hmm. Or
there are no real strict rules, because like my mother, if she had leftover fried rice, she would make that into a rice ball, and the ingredients would be all blended, right? And when we were living in America, she loved Jolly Green Giant's frozen vegetables were actually mixed into our onigiri. And my mother was, you know, raising five kids. She just didn't even have time to defrost them. So sometimes those would get into the hot rice. And when we were eating the onigiri, you would like feel the crunch of the frozen vegetable. But, you know, it could also be chopped herbs. And it actually makes it very colorful and pretty, as well as more nutritious. You could also take like a piece of flaked salmon from last night's dinner, or just cook some salmon, or open a can of tuna and mix it with some mayo and onions and use it as a stuffing in the middle, and then you just cover it up so it's hidden inside. And make sure you don't put too much of it, because then it becomes more about the stuffing and the ball will not hold together.
Yeah, and we have to be careful because we Americans, we like to, you know, put a ton of stuff, but it has to just be a little bit.
Yeah, about 25%. If it falls apart, don't worry. You're wrapping it with nori. That will kind of hold it together and act like an envelope. And if it falls apart and it sticks all over your fingers, that's also part of the fun. Or use a fork if you can't manage, you know, eating it with just your fingers.
So we've been saying rice balls, but I mean, most of my favorite shapes are either the triangular ones or the ones that are sort of like a cone, I guess.
Oh, you mean a triangle, like a pyramid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the classic onigiri. But you could also have barrel shape. You could have a disc shape, and you could have a snowball or shape. So that's probably the easiest one to start. I had this boy in my junior high school. He came from a single family. His father was the one who made the onigiris for his bento box. And it looked like, you know, those Olympic shot puts. Huge, huge. And he would wrap it in this big, you know, piece of nori. So it was this black ball stuffed with one little, you know, pickled plum. And he would bring three dried sardines with it. And with my girlfriends, we would always stare at him, you know, when he was eating that. But he looked really happy, you know.
I love that story. Are there techniques that we need to know to keep the rice off our hands? Like, do we dip our hands in water?
Yes. So the technique is you have a little finger bowl. You have your fresh rice and also a little, just a little bowl of salt, you know, a couple teaspoons, sea salt. You dip your hand in water and then two fingers into the salt, and you spread the salt all over your hands and make sure your hands are not dripping with water. And then you pick up the rice. So the rice could be a little warm, but not hot, right? And then by then, you know, your filling should already be in the middle or spread, you know, blended into the rice. And you just pick up the whole thing and you just start making that snowball. And if you want to have that pyramid or triangle or cone shape, you just use your hand to mold it into that triangle. And you just have to keep pressing it, but don't press it too much. It's soft inside and firm outside like a pillow.
And if you make too many, or you want to make them all with the rice that you have, what do you do with some that end up being refrigerated so they still have that wonderful, warm mouthfeel?
Ideally, they shouldn't be refrigerated, because what happens to rice is when it goes into the fridge, it gets really dry and hard and not very flavorful. But people will, in Japan, microwave it. That's the thing they love doing. Or you could put it in a steamer, but you have to be careful because it will fall apart. My suggestion is that if it was just made, you know, this is a picnic food, so it's like a sandwich. You know, you're taking it with you. A few hours is going to be okay outside. And if you have to put it in the fridge, then just expect that it's not going to be as good as when you just made it.
There's this tradition of making bento boxes adorable. Do onigiri ever get decorated?
Oh, of course, yes. It's the star of the bento box. I mean, onigiri lends itself to that kind of play with food idea, and I do that a lot with kids.
Do you ever use organic edible flower petals in them?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, you could even like break the like nasturtiums and edible dahlias, chamomile flowers, basil flowers. And you know, if you can't stuff everything, just put it on the side. Serve it as a pickle or just as a little thing to munch on. There are a lot of onigiri cafes that you could go in Japan. So you get two onigiris, you get some pickles, and you get miso soup.
Perfect.
It's a perfect meal.
Find a recipe for Sonoko Sakai's bacon and scrambled egg onigiri on the Good Food blog. Next, we take another food crawl with Jonathan Gold. This time, it's for Asian fried chicken. I know you're going to stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
I'm really super happy to have a new branch of Gus's Fried Chicken from Memphis here. It's delicious. And we've talked about Howling Rays. It's turning into a really good fried chicken town.
That's our favorite food critic, the one and only Jonathan Gold.
There are so many chicken frying traditions all over Asia. Every country has their own. And we're lucky to have a lot of them available in the San Gabriel Valley and thereabouts.
So tell me what you're doing here.
I'm fried the chicken, so 6 minutes. Maybe if you like more crispy, you can maybe more 2 minutes, yeah.
Let's start at Mary's House of Chicken. It's a style from Java called Ayam Goreng Cremesan. The chicken is braised with all kinds of spices, then very briefly fried, and it's super crunchy, yet it's soft and moist and spicy on the inside. And it comes with handfuls of fried rice flour crumbles. So it's like a crunchy thing with satellite crunch. You can't believe how good this chicken is. It's far for probably most of the listeners. It's not just in West Covina, but in the far part of West Covina. But it's worth the drive sometime.
Wow.
Mary's House of Chicken.
Okay. And where are we headed next?
Tokyo Fried Chicken. When people think about Japanese fried chicken, they mostly think of karaage, which are those fried chicken things that come alongside the teriyaki and plate lunches.
Yeah, boneless.
Yeah, it's delicious. Tokyo Fried Chicken is sort of a southern fried chicken tradition crossed with, I guess, Japanese/Korean fried chicken. But it's really good. I'm not sure especially what makes it Japanese, because you wait in line for it. There's always a line. You sit down and there's blues music just blasting from the speakers. And the chicken is very close to Korean fried chicken, which is to say, you know, nicely marinated, super crisp, but that fragile skin.
Not breaded and crisp.
Not breaded and crisp. You know those bears that usually squeeze honey out of? They have two different kinds of ponzu sauce in there. One spicy, one less so. Ponzu being the soy citrus mixture that's common with Japanese fry foods. And you can get things like collard greens braised in dashi and carrots candied with soy and served with bacon. It's a delightful place.
And you can eat your fried chicken there with a plastic glove. So great. Next.
We have to have a Korean chicken in this roundup, and I've chosen Obi Bear. Obi Bear is very old school. It's been around a while. They serve what people think of as KFC, Korean fried chicken. But people mostly go there for the wings, which are delicious, or for whole fried game hen.
And what do you get when you're there?
I get the wings, which are just spicy and they're salty and they're bright red. And they ruin more shirts than anything in Koreatown.
Is there garlic involved with those wings?
There's probably some garlic involved. You should get a leek pancake alongside it.
That's your Korean fried chicken pick. We're halfway through our crawl. Where's the next stop?
Thai fried chicken. There's all kinds of Thai fried chicken, but there's this particular style from northern Thailand that's a specialty of pak pak. Andy Rickard does a really nice version of it for the summer. I would say the edge here goes to Chris Yenbangroom from Night Market Song, who used to serve it with a sauce flavored with water bugs, but he took the water bugs right out of there. Chicken's the same, and it's delicious, and it comes with a chili dip. Totally recommended.
Where are we headed next?
Max's of Manila. It would be almost impossible to think of Asian fried chicken in L.A. without Max's of Manila, which is a chain, you know, based in the Philippines. There's been one in L.A. forever, at least since the 80s. It has a really particular, almost like fast foody smell to it, but it's kind of addictive, and you get delicious glasses of calamansi juice to go with it.
Fried chicken and calamansi juice. I like it. And does that about do it for us?
I think the last will be Sichuan fried chicken. In most of the new wave of Sichuan restaurants in L.A., there will be one version or another of la ziji or spicy fried chicken. They tend to be more in places that are in the Chongqing style as opposed to the Chengdu style. So Chengdu taste and Sichuan impression don't have it. But the version at Dongpo in Arcadia, which we talked about a few weeks ago, it's absolutely delicious, like thick chunks without the bones in it. The bones are sometimes more delicious, but some of the super traditional places, you get more bone than you do chicken. There's sesame seeds involved, a little bit of a glaze, and it comes on this plate that's mounded maybe 6 or 8 inches high with fried Japanese chili peppers. So it looks like firecrackers have gone off in your plate and left behind a little bit of delicious chicken.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. Find a map of his favorite Asian fried chicken spots in Los Angeles on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And don't forget, if you text the words good food to 69866, you get more weekly restaurant recommendations. That's it for this week's show. Go to kcrw.com or download our mobile app to listen to the show. You can also find our podcast and the first installment of a bonus podcast devoted to pie on iTunes. It's called the Good Food Piecast. Catchy, right? As always, many thanks to the Good Food Squadron. That's
Abby Fentress-Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say.
Pete Bloomberg.
Joel Stein.
Jackie Liu.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with more good food. P.S. One more thing. Come to our pie pop-up tomorrow at Smorgasburg at the Alameda Produce Market. I'll be answering all your pie inquiries from 11 to 3. There's more details on the Good Food Instagram feed, but basically, you have a question, I will attempt to have an answer. See you there. Sitting on your caviar. Now your bracelets, your fur.